The headlines. Yemeni officials slam Saudi Arabia for refusing to allow three fuel ships to dock in Hodeidah port despite securing UN clearance. Iraq's Prime Minister orders an investigation into the violence which erupted during Friday's protests against parliamentary election results. And the trial of three white men charged with last year's killing of young black man Ahmad Arbery begins in the U.S. state of Georgia. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock in Hodeidah port. In a statement, the company says the Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says that the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed its vital infrastructure. The UN says that more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation there the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The West's all-out support for Saudi Arabia does not seem to be subsiding. That's amid concerns by anti-war and human rights organizations that the Saudi regime uses all the support to press ahead with its now years-long deadly aggression against Yemen and its civilian population.
The United States has approved a potential weapon sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. On Thursday, the Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The State Department said the sale is fully consistent with the administration's pledge to co-lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend itself. Yemen's Ansarullah movement reacted, saying the arms sales prove that U.S. administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. This is seen as the first major arms sales to Riyadh since President Joe Biden took the helm at the White House. But such weapons transfer is not limited to the current administration. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed a mega weapons sales deal worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The recent deals have made Saudi Arabia become the largest importer of American arms and munitions. According to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, 1/4 of America's arms exports go directly to the kingdom. The report also says that between 2016 and 2020, Saudi weapons purchases only from the United States accounted for 79% of the country's total arms imports. Many believe the U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia serves no one but arms manufacturing companies.
These are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
But the United States is not the only country that provides Saudis with weapons. The UK, Canada, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany are among other major exporters of weapons to the Al Saud dynasty. The arms supplies of Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Anti-war and human rights organizations have long sounded the alarm over the loss of human lives as a result of the West-backed Saudi aggression on Yemen. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced millions more. The aggression has also brought millions of Yemenis to the brink of acute starvation due to attacks on the country's vital infrastructure. The United Nations has already described the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Iraq's prime minister has ordered an investigation into the violence which erupted during Friday's protests against parliamentary election results. Mustafa al-Kadhimi announced the formation of a committee to look into clashes during demonstrations in Baghdad. The committee will try to uncover the circumstances surrounding the deaths and injuries of protesters, as well as security forces. Meanwhile, senior Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr said that the people should hold street protests against the election results in a peaceful manner. In a tweet, he noted that such rallies should not lead to violence and the humiliation of the government. Iraqis have held several rallies against the vote outcome that initially put the Saad bloc in the lead. Iraq's Fatah Alliance said international observers recorded numerous violations during the voting process and counting. The federal court has yet to certify the final results. A report suggests that the U.S. government tried to influence Iraq's recent parliamentary elections with the help of Turkey. The Cradle News says that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan attempted to form a united or a unified Sunni front in Iraq's October elections. According to the report, Erdogan organized a meeting with two top Iraqi Sunni politicians at the behest of Washington. Iraq's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad al-Halbousi, and the leader of the Azm coalition, Khamis al-Khanjar, were flown to Ankara, but they failed to form a coalition. The report says that Erdogan had organized a meeting in return for a $15 billion investment by the United Arab Emirates. This is the latest revelation about the recent votes in Iraq that has been mired in fraud claims, leading to violent protests. An anti-establishment demonstration has turned violent in the British capital, with police clashing with protesters in central London. At least 8 officers were injured during scuffles in Parliament Square. The Metropolitan Police said that 12 people were arrested. Demonstrators wearing masks had gathered nearby Trafalgar Square, with some throwing Molotov cocktails at the officers. They also burnt an effigy of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in show of anger at his policies. November 5th marks an annual Million Mask March, which draws massive rallies against government overreach, income inequality, and more recently, COVID-19 restrictions.
100 establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these Senate arse and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, their criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Purizap, London.
France's healthcare used to be the envy of the world, but austerity cuts have rapidly caused it to plummet in international rankings. A new report says that 20% of hospital beds across France have closed since the start of COVID-19. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019, which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009.
As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals.
We absolutely can't talk about France having the best healthcare system in the world anymore, not when we can't even take decent care of people who are already dying. People are dying in atrocious conditions. It's not because nurses are negligent, but because we are overworked and because our current politicians don't care about the health of the people.
It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services even amid the corona instability.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating corona because they were forcing the cuts before corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The United States and China have once again engaged in acrimonious exchanges over the issue of Taiwan. Western support for the island, which is claimed by China, has once again angered the Chinese government.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region. Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Well, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has been quick to respond to the top U.S. general. It urged the U.S. not to send any wrong signals to the island so as to not seriously damage the China-U.S. relations and the peace and stability in the region.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the US. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The US has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And U.S. President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight. The recent Kabul drone strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing at the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the airstrike as a success and preventing a second attack on U.S. forces at Kabul airport. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. We'll prepare for you an article written by Daniel Larrison, a contributing editor and weekly columnist for antiwar.com website. The piece is titled Shut Down the Drone War.
Thank you.
The 29th of August U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, demonstrates the bankruptcy of the so-called war on terror. Like many other drone strikes, the strike in Kabul targeted innocent people and achieved nothing except to blow up civilians that had the misfortune to be in the vicinity. According to 2 recent investigative reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post, the vehicle targeted in the airstrike carried no explosives whatsoever, and the car's driver was Zamari Ahmadi, an aid worker who had spent the day delivering water to those in need. Hailed as a righteous strike by the U.S. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Kabul drone strike was an atrocity that should never have happened. The Biden administration has emphasized that the U.S. possesses over-the-horizon capabilities to continue waging war in Afghanistan even after the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from the country. But the 29th of August airstrike shows why the U.S. should not be using them. The recent Kabul strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing of the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the strike as a success in preventing a second attack on U.S. forces. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. As Ahmadi's brother, Amal, told the New York Times, "All of them were innocent. You say he was Daesh, but he actually worked for the Americans." U.S. military has defended the airstrike, but all of their specific claims fall apart under scrutiny. U.S. officials claim there was a secondary explosion that proves the explosives were present in the car, but according to investigative reports, no such second explosion occurred. The objects that they believe to be explosives were in fact water containers. Despite surveying Ahmadi for 8 hours on that day, they managed to get every important detail wrong about what he was doing, who he was with, and what he was transporting. The killing of these 10 innocent people is an outrage, but the bigger outrage is that this strike is not an outlier. Things like this have been happening in Afghanistan as well as in other countries for years, but they have received little or no attention. When these attacks take place in remote areas, as they often do, it is difficult for investigators and journalists to determine what really happened. Because the strike occurred in a major city, there were lots of witnesses and journalists could piece together the evidence much more easily. Who knows how many other innocent people have been targeted in the same way that Zamari Ahmadi was? How many people have been executed like this, simply for going about their daily business? Who seriously believes that this has anything to do with the security of the United States? Thanks to Daniel Hale's whistleblowing, we now know that the U.S. drone warfare frequently kills civilians, and in some cases, most or all of the victims are actually civilians. As Daniel Hale has said, "With drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. Many of the people targeted by drone strikes are not necessarily even militants, but just happen to be military-age males. Because the military wrongly assumes that everyone killed in an airstrike is an enemy combatant, unless proven otherwise, the number of civilians killed by U.S. drone strikes is bound to be considerably higher than the government acknowledges." The military has actually made a habit of either not counting or undercounting the civilian victims of U.S. airstrikes and drone strikes. The U.S.-led bombing campaign against Daesh in Iraq killed many thousands of innocent civilians, but the military acknowledged only a very small number of these. Asmat Khan and Anand Gopal reported in 2017, we found that one in five of the coalition airstrikes we identified resulted in civilian deaths, a rate more than 31 times that acknowledged by the coalition. It is at such a distance from official claims that, in terms of civilian deaths, this may be the least transparent war in recent American history. U.S. airstrikes in Somalia have killed dozens of civilians, but U.S. AFRICOM Command has acknowledged only five. The Kabul airstrike fits into this pattern. 10 people were killed, but the U.S. military owned up only to killing 3 adults. Drone strikes have served as the background noise of U.S. warfare for the last decade and a half, and as such, they are mostly ignored until they cause enough loss of life to register briefly under radar of Western media outlets. The drone war has continued across 4 administrations, and in recent years, the conduct of that war and the casualties that it has caused have been increasingly difficult to track. If Americans had a clearer view of who the victims of drone strikes really are, more of us would realize that the drone war needs to be shut down. It is not making the U.S. any safer, and even if it were doing so at the margins, it comes at an unacceptably high price in terms of innocent lives lost. No government has the right to do what ours did to these 10 people in Afghanistan. And there is no justification for continuing a policy that regularly results in such slaughter.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. We have an interesting story for today. A young man was proud of his healthy and beautiful heart. One day, standing in the middle of the town, he proclaimed that he had the most beautiful heart in the whole valley. A large crowd gathered to have a look at his heart. His heart was smooth, shiny, and looked very healthy. Indeed, the man had the most beautiful heart in the valley, everyone agreed. The proud young man felt delighted and boasted his perfect heart, which everyone admired. Suddenly, a voice from the crowd said, "Your heart is not as beautiful as mine." The young man searched for the person, and an old man appeared in front of him. "Show us your heart if you believe you have got more beautiful heart than mine," said the young man. The old man carefully showed his heart. The crowd and the young man looked at the old man's heart. The heart was beating strongly and healthily, but it was not smooth and shiny as the young man's heart. Instead, it had scars all over it. It had places where some pieces of the heart had been removed and other pieces were put in. The other pieces didn't fit perfectly, and there were several uneven edges. In some places, there were deep gouges where some pieces were missing. The crowd laughed at the old man's heart. How can he claim that he has the most beautiful heart when it is all scarred and uneven? They thought. The young man looked at the old man's heart and laughed. "You must be kidding. Compare your heart and mine," My heart looks perfect and smooth, and yours is a mess of scars and tears. Yes, your heart looks perfect, but I would never trade your heart with mine, said the old man. Every scar in my heart represents a person whom I had given my love. I tear a piece of my heart and give to them. Often my loved one gives me back a piece of their heart, which fits into the empty place in my heart. Since everyone loves each other in a different way, their piece of heart may not perfectly fit my heart, so you can see some rough edges. These scars and rough edges remind me of the love we shared, he continued. Sometimes I would give a piece of my heart, but the other person may not return a piece of his heart to me. These are the empty gouges. Although these gouges are painful, these remind me of the love I have for these people too. So do you now see what a true beauty? Asked the old man. The young man and crowd stood silently, with tears running down their cheeks. The young man walked to the old man, reached into his perfect, young and beautiful heart, ripped a piece out of it, and offered it to the man with trembling hands. The old man gratefully received, placed it in his heart, and then took a piece from his old heart and placed it in the young man's heart. The young man looked at his heart. It did not look shiny and smooth like it used to, but it was now more beautiful because he could feel the love from the old man's heart flowing into him. Sayyid Hussein Al-Ghazwini.
One of the most sensitive topics to discuss is the topic of love. There are many that spend a lifetime in pursuit of true love, to find the one that they truly love. There are some people that commit all sorts of sins and haram acts with the excuse that they are in love. It's as if love justifies everything. It justifies committing sins. It justifies committing haram, sins that are very big in the eyes of Allah, because they are in love. There are some that think love is fake. It doesn't exist. It's only something in our minds. There's no reality to love. There are others who believe that love is the drive behind everything that human beings do. Is love a good thing or a bad thing? It depends on who you ask, which philosopher, which thinker. There are some that think love is fake. It doesn't exist. It's in people's imaginations. It's something that was made up for economic reasons, for consumerism, to make money, to get money from people's pockets. How? By making up something called love, so that people go on dates, they buy gifts, weddings, spend money on flowers, spend money on chocolates. There's Valentine's Day, and it's a time for the economy to receive a boost. It's nothing but consumerism. It's nothing but an idea to boost the economy. This is on one hand. On the other hand, there are other thinkers that believe love is the drive behind every single human behavior. The reason why we go to school is because of love. The reason why we get a college education is because of love. We want to get married. We want to impress someone. The reason why we go to work and make money and buy a nice house and buy a nice car and drive the nicest clothing and put on makeup and wear the nicest dresses, it's only for love. Only to either find a new love or maintain the love that we have. Every human behavior, the main drive behind it is love. So as you see, there is a wide spectrum of theories on love, and the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And then you have Hollywood's version of love. And this is where things become catastrophic. Hollywood gives us the image that life revolves around love. not love of country, not love of God, not to contribute and achieve or do something for your faith or your country. No, life revolves around love, and that you should sacrifice everything for love. Even if you love a complete stranger, if you fall in love with a complete stranger, you should sacrifice everything you have for the stranger. Even if you're married, even if you have a wife and children and a fantastic job and a lovely house, but if you fall in love, you pursue love. Even if it means you have to move across the globe to pursue that love, you sacrifice everything for love. A husband, even if he has a loving wife and children and a nice job, but if he falls in love with someone else, you should sacrifice everything. Or on the contrary, if a woman has a loving husband, children, but she falls in love, she should sacrifice everything for the sake of love. This is the image that Hollywood gives us of love. This is the Hollywood version of love. And that if you don't pursue love, you will live a miserable life, a life of misery, a life of depression, and you will never be happy if you don't pursue true love. This is the image. When you watch a Hollywood movie, this is the image that you receive. This is the message that you receive. And this is ridiculous. In Islam, we believe in love. Love is not fake. Love is not just in the head. Love is real. It's very much real. Love is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And it's something very beautiful. However, but you don't ruin your family over what you perceive as love. And it could be something else. It could be infatuation. It could be lust. It could be simple attraction. You think it's love, and you sacrifice everything that you have for what you perceive as love. This is what Islam does not accept. Islam says no. This is animalistic form of love. This is blind love that Islam does not accept. Also, another problem of the Hollywood version of love is that they give us the wrong image. It gives us the wrong image. You see the husband, he's romantic all the time. He's always calling his beloved, sending gifts and flowers, and taking his wife or the one he loves to romantic places and so on and so forth. And the wife is so romantic, and everything is all around. Life revolves around romance. And that is how meant, and that is how life is meant to be. This is wrong. This is wrong. This is a wrong image. This is not how life is meant to be. This is not how reality is. But they give you this image. And that is why many people, after watching a romantic movie from Hollywood, they develop a dissatisfaction. They're disappointed with their significant other. The wife comes back home and she says, why can't you be as romantic as the guy in the movie? He's so romantic. Why can't you be as sweet and generous and loving and romantic as everyone else? And I don't know who she's talking about, everyone else. It's just an actor in a movie which is fake, which is meant to distract people. Or the husband is dissatisfied or disappointed with his wife because she's not like the actress in the movie. She's not as romantic as the wife in the movie. And this is very disturbing. It ruins families.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
To reduce building sector emissions and improve health and well-being, there is no more important place to start than the home. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Cosima Starr and Rebecca Ochong. The piece is titled Housing Buildings Are Key to Sustainable Development. The article has been published by the Asia Times. In the transition to a low-carbon, resilient and sustainable society and economy, buildings and construction activities play a critical role as they are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. As a matter of fact, they are responsible for more than 38% of global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions, higher than any other sector. To tackle buildings' emissions and pressing housing issues holistically, it is important to think and act across sectors and engage with all stakeholders. Pressing challenges like climate change, housing for all, environmental degradation, and health cannot be tackled one by one and in silos, but rather need to be approached in an integrated manner. This multi-solving is what sustainable consumption and production, or SCP, one of the keystones of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, stand for. At the fully virtual 8th Asia-Pacific Housing Forum, funded Switch Asia SCP Facility and Habitat for Humanity, taking place from 7th to 9th of December 2021, discussions among multiple sector stakeholders will be brought forward. The Housing Forum, with the theme Building Forward Better for Inclusive Housing, highlights the urgent need for building sustainable, affordable housing through inclusive approaches. Many developing countries must deal with the challenges of making adequate housing available, as well as climate change mitigation and adaptation in their building sectors. When carefully planned, mitigation and adaptation strategies for buildings not only can stimulate the growth of new businesses and jobs, but can also contribute to other development goals such as clean air, healthy environment, access to clean energy and clean water, and making cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. Among critical elements that deserves particular attention is the social dimension, as it is in housing that social inequalities are felt most deeply. Social inequalities have been evident during COVID-19 lockdowns, when the most vulnerable could not safely shelter in place because of a lack of decent, safe, adequate and affordable housing. When we talk about housing and health, no one should be left behind. That means tackling all the barriers in what we call the housing ecosystem. The housing ecosystem is composed by all the social norms, formal and informal institutions, and trends and events that influence how people act to make changes that they value in their housing situations. At the center of the housing ecosystem are people with their capabilities, vulnerabilities, voices, and influence. They are the ones who will make changes around their housing situations and who will define and realize the ways to improve their lives. Some Asian governments have already made commitments to provide adequate housing to all. This means homes that need to be affordable, safe and secure, and provide healthy living spaces, comfortable in terms of temperature, light, noise level and indoor air quality. This ambition should be the starting point for any intervention on reducing emissions. In its regional roadmap for buildings and construction in Asia, the Global Alliance for Building and Construction lays out the many benefits arising from tackling the climate change holistically by putting human needs at the center, considering resulting social, economic, and health benefits. For example, improving access to clean energy not only solidifies climate commitments but also leads to health benefits and poverty alleviation as air pollution is reduced and employment is created. Community-based micro-entrepreneurs are needed to build and service decentralized renewable energy installations. The health impacts of switching to clean energy and green buildings are real. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that around 7 million people die every year from air pollution. Buildings and household air pollution can significantly increase the risk of both communicable and non-communicable diseases, including cardiovascular and respiratory diseases, pneumonia, stroke, and lung cancer. A holistic approach that puts human needs at the center is championed by the uptake of SCP practices. These encourage us to see all sectors as part of a human-built system that can and needs to be changed when joint societal goals, such as those formulated in the SDGs or the Paris Climate Accord, are not being met. For example, updating building codes to integrate sustainability and climate change can also integrate mandates for non-toxic building materials, as well as standards for thermal comfort, light, noise, and indoor air quality, thereby preventing diseases and improving residents' well-being. All stakeholders must be involved to improve the climate impacts of a sector, and any intervention needs to consider its wide-ranging negative and positive impacts. This is particularly important for policymakers. While climate commitments may be long-term and made at the international level, developing solutions that are meaningful for living conditions and quality of life are immediate and highly local. Since 2007, a program has implemented 15 grant projects contributing to sustainable housing in South, Southeast, and East Asia. The program is also providing technical assistance to Pakistan on developing a green building code and to Kyrgyzstan on promoting energy efficiency in the construction sector. The Switch Asia Switch Off Air Pollution project, implemented in Mongolia, offers a practical example of how building and ensuring access to sustainable and healthy homes can improve public health outcomes, reduce inequalities, mitigate carbon, and improve urban sustainability and resilience. To respond to the increasing levels of toxic air pollution in Ulaanbaatar, the world's coldest capital city, Switch Asia was initiated in 2018 to promote energy efficiency in Mongolia's housing sector. The project is working to increase community awareness on the importance of insulation and its benefits by promoting a step-by-step approach. This has been done by developing an affordable building retrofit of varying cost and efficiency for households based on the needs and financial capacity of individual families. Soap retrofitting solutions can save families up to 70% of energy costs if fully implemented. The benefits of these solutions include improved health, increased energy efficiency and increased comfort, extra savings from heating, and reduced workload from coal burning. Working towards these objectives, the project's team is active on the ground, connecting households with local construction workers, qualified suppliers, and green loans from financial institutions through a standardized delivery model that ensures the quality of the implementation and sustainability of the market mechanism. Capacity building of stakeholders of the delivery model is ensured continuously. Furthermore, the developed technical procedures of the project are included in the construction codes and standards of buildings, envelope, thermal insulation of Mongolia. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa maulana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Death is a certainty, and we know it. But unfortunately, many of us do not prepare for it. It is something that, especially during this time, this pandemic, you know, it came to many people who we may have known very suddenly. You know, some people who we may have known who are recovering, all of a sudden, you know, pass away. So it's humble advice to myself and to all my dear listeners to, you know, prepare for something that is certain. It may not be now, it may not be tomorrow, but it's a certainty that will occur. In this tradition from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the Imam speaks about the believers in the barzakh. Now, one of the things that must be mentioned here is that the concept of barzakh is a very difficult concept to truly understand and truly explain. There are many different things. Is barzakh a realm outside of this realm? Is it a part of this realm? And obviously the philosophers, the mutakallimeen, the theologians, and obviously the mystics and the urafa all have different understandings and opinions on what barzakh actually is. And one thing is certain is that some of the things that are mentioned about the barzakh may not be as it seems. There may be, you know, a deeper understanding to what it actually may be. And it is just a means for us to get an understanding of how that thing may be. It is a simile or a parable. And this is what the late Marhum Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi speaks about in his book, Theological Instructions. There is a textbook in terms of learning Islamic theology and Kalam about Ma'ad and so on. Brothers and sisters who wish to find out more can refer to this book. But in this tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he speaks about the barzakh and the souls of the believers, inshallah, may we be of them in that particular realm or place. So the Imam alayhi salam says that the souls of the believers will be in chambers in paradise. Now, the hadith looks, but you know, oh, okay, you're saying paradise, but you mentioned barzakh. We understand that the day of judgment has not taken place by what the Imam says in the next part. So the Imam says that the souls of the believers will be in chambers in paradise, eating of its foods and drinking its drinks and visiting one another. So the believers will recognize one another. They will be visiting. They will be sitting down and, you know, having breakfast together or having lunch together, drinking together, eating together. And it's from this phrase that we will mention that it is clear that the day of judgment has not happened yet. So this paradise that the Imam is saying is not the paradise. It is, you know, maybe a lower level of it. Again, the discussion is vast. So the Imam then says that these people who are visiting one another, who are having drinks together, who are, you know, eating together, will say, "Our Lord, bring the final hour so that you may fulfill what you have promised us." So from this verse, it is clear that the final hour has not happened. So it is a middle realm between this world and the next, what is known as purgatory, the barzakh. And the believers are enjoying themselves. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of these believers, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.